Welcome to Mind Walk, produced at Upstart Radio for Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Radio Free Moscow, IndieMedia.org, RadioForAll.net, community and micropower stations worldwide.
Hi, this is Dickie Richards, former child actor, and this is a public service announcement. You know when you're watching one of those action-adventure movies and Joe Action Hero is blowing the shit out of all the bad guys with an Uzi? What invariably happens is that Joe Action Hero runs out of bullets, throws his Uzi to the ground, and goes for his pistol. If you've ever experienced real poverty, as I have, you will be deeply disturbed by this scene. These guys are throwing away perfectly good Uzis. You'd be lucky to buy one of these guns in the black market for $2,000. I mean, Jesus Christ, don't throw away the Uzi. Take it with you. Who knows? Maybe you'll run into a whole stockpile of ammo, and you could reload your Uzi and rack up a triple-digit body count. Maybe you'll meet a girl that's into men who are dangerous, and she'll think, ooh, now that's the kind of reckless, Uzi-toting bad boy I want to get to know a little better. While Joe Action Hero is throwing away Uzis like they grow on trees, there are people starving in the third world who would kill to have an Uzi. And like the arrogant, exploitative Westerner that you are, Mr. Joe Action Hero, instead of donating your Uzi to one of those poor, starving children in the third world, what do? You throw it away as you would anything else that you can no longer exploit. Let me tell you something, Mr. Joe Action Hero. You're a fucking pig, and you better start changing your tune and start thinking less about yourself and more about your fellow man. So either hold on to that Uzi or donate it to charity. You fucking son of a...
Behold, I am reborn. Down darkened stairways leading to subterranean labyrinths.
On journeys far and wide.
Behold,
I am reborn.
Behold,
I am reborn.
Behold,
I am reborn. Oogliette of damned design. Oogliette of damned design. Oogliette of damned design. The forest has burned.
The Republic should die to the sound of applause.
Behold! Behold!
The concrete shoes, the hungry lady. This is all I ask of you. The concrete shoes, rubber boots. This is all I ask. The hungry lady. The concrete shoes. Brother Zeus.
Oogliette of damned design.
How does it feel to be spaceborne?
We need to know what we're doing in order to know how to do it right.
Less than 10% of the insurgents are foreign fighters. I mean, we're basically there in the middle of a power struggle among three factions in a country that we're most of the people think we have no right to be anyway.
The rhetoric of Mr. Cheney in this regard sounds to me like it belongs more in 2003 and 2004, not in 2005. I think the president and Cheney are not winning right now. Issue 2. Murtha wants out. Odom agrees.
This is a real war where people are getting killed. 15,000 people have been wounded, and half of them are desperately wounded, blinded, without their arms. I mean, it breaks my heart when I go out there and see these kids. I see wives who can't look at their husbands because they've been so disfigured. I saw a young fellow that was paralyzed from the neck down, and his three children were standing there crying with his wife and his mother. So this is a real war, which we have to find a solution. And since there's no progress, we've got to find a way to let the Iraqis take over.
Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said he has given the commanders on the ground everything they've requested, including troop levels.
Tim, come on. They fired Shinseki when he said they needed 200,000 troops. They had 44,000 shortage of armored vests. They had no one brigade had one jammer in it. That's what the troops told me. I came back and they started to come up with that stuff. People had to buy their own armor. We had a young fella, and this is a tragic story. He's blinded and lost his foot. Walter Reed did everything, and they're doing a marvelous job rehabilitating people there. But they put him out in the early stages of the war, and he went home, and nobody was home. His father was in jail, and there was nobody at home. He's by himself. But they sent him to John Hopkins to see, because they're one of the best in the world. They started sending bills. Then they sent a collection agency. Well, you know, we obviously got that worked out. The point I'm making is this has been mishandled, and we should be firing people and going in another direction. The troops did not have what they needed.
Should the president fire Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld?
Well, he's got to decide who he fires. I mean, he's got to make up his mind about who he fired. I recommended that Wolfowitz ought to be fired a long time ago because he was a professor, not an administrator. And of course, they promoted him to the World Bank. But I'm convinced that the people. I have never seen such an outpouring in the 32 years I've been in Congress of support and people with tears in their eyes, people walking along clapping when I'm walking through the halls of Congress saying something needed to be said. So they're thirsting for a solution to this, and the president can't hide behind rhetoric, and neither can the vice president. And Republican members of Congress can't say because I'm a Democrat. I led the fight to go to war in 91 with President Bush 1. He knew what he was doing. That $60 billion was paid by our allies. And we had a coalition, a real coalition of forces, and he had an exit strategy. And he didn't go into Iraq. And why didn't he go into Iraq? Because he said, I don't want to occupy it. I don't want to reconstruct it. And he knew what he was doing. He was an experienced president. He's got to get some experienced people to give him some advice and ask for some bipartisan support. President Bush 1 did this continually. He asked, he didn't like what we said sometimes, but he listened to what we were saying.
Let me ask you straight. Do you have confidence in Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld?
Well, I put it this way. There have been an awful lot of mistakes made. And I don't know whether it's his fault, but when he forced the military, now this is what I hear from the military, he forced them to go in with inadequate forces. Then he thought we were going to be able to go through Turkey. You remember we had the best division, the most technologically advanced division sitting off Turkey. And so fortunately we had enough troops to get through. But then for the transition, where he completely miscalculated the transition. So the president has to look at that. And then Abu Ghraib. They had inexperienced people without supervision in Abu Ghraib, and that caused us, that's when the tide turned. The casualties have gone from one a day to two a day to the last month, four a day casualties. Now, that's happened because you've got to win the hearts and minds of the people. We are not winning the hearts and minds of the people. Even the military operations, Tim, when we throw people out of their homes, cause us tremendous problems. Inadvertently, that's the way the military operates.
The Democrats have been somewhat tepid in their response to you. However, Nancy Pelosi, leader of the Democrats in the House, said, quote, I think that Mr. Murtha speaks for himself. Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate, I don't support immediate withdrawal. John Kerry, the Democratic standard bearer in 2004, I respectfully disagree with John Murtha. So you have some work to do with your own party. Do you now believe your vote for the war in Iraq in 2002 was a mistake?
Obviously it was a mistake. I mean, all of us were misled by the information that we had. I remember going to Iraq right before, or going to Kuwait right before the war started. And they drew a line, a red line around Baghdad, and they said they're going to attack us with weapons of mass destruction. I believed that. And so did the military. And they thought they could put up with that. But when they didn't use those weapons of mass destruction, when we didn't find them, and they kept saying we're going to find them to the very end, I knew we had made a mistake. We have increased terrorism in the Middle East is what we've done. And, and since we're the target, we've increased instability in the Middle East. So the only way to do this is to redeploy our forces outside, let the Iraqis handle this themselves.
The war over the war turned really ugly today. At issue, Democratic Congressman John Murtha's proposal yesterday for a resolution for the U.S. to start redeploying from Iraq at the earliest practicable date. Those are his words. The Republican arm of the House first criticized his suggestion, then decided to introduce a resolution of its own calling for troops to be brought back from Iraq right now. And suddenly, a deadly serious issue, the role of the United States in Iraq, became political theater.
You talk about your respect for Mr. Murtha. You talk about his known knowledge to the military. And yet it's you, sir, that come down here and say that the Republican chairman of the House Armed Services Committee proposes that the House of Representatives put their statement and their resolve that we should deploy immediately from Iraq and not protect our troops, apparently, because it doesn't say that. And not provide for their safety, not provide for redeployment somewhere over the horizon so we'll be sure that terrorism doesn't spread there and we'll be ready for any emergency. If instead you want the troops to get the message that that's not what we want, then why didn't you work with your delegation over there to make sure Mr. Murtha's resolution could be proposed and debated and explained fully, and that this country could have the benefit of a full discussion of where the policy is going, because this administration apparently has no clue and has no idea. They politicized the lead-up going into the area, and now you are politicizing how it is we're going to get this country back in order.
Gentlemen's time has expired. This is a counterfeit. This is an insult to this institution. And to not allow us to have a real debate, to not allow us to bring up different proposals, I think is undercuts the process. Let me yield 10 seconds, 15 seconds, gentlemen.
I'd like to ask the gentleman from California why he introduced a counterfeit Murtha resolution rather than allowing us to vote on the real Murtha motion if he wanted us to vote at all.
Let me answer, my friend. This is a letter from an Army captain in Iraq. He says in this email, I am a U.S. Army captain currently serving in Iraq, and
I want an answer from you, not somebody else.
Gentleman from California has the time.
He says, I am shocked and appalled by Rep. Murtha's call for an immediate withdrawal. Please, please, please convince your colleague to let us finish this critical job.
This information from the White House.
He is correct that deployments and service and the casualties are hard on all of us. He is wrong about what is demoralizing us. What is demoralizing is a Congress which no longer stands behind our mission. That's why we're offering this resolution.
Will the gentleman yield?
That's obviously the message that's going out to thousands of servicemen.
Will the gentleman yield? That's because you're sending that message.
Gentlemen.
Jack Murtha isn't sending that message. You are, in the White House is.
And that's not even the debate on the resolution, just the debate on whether to debate the resolution. About 10 minutes later, during this procedural vote, things got really bad.
A few minutes ago, I received a call from Colonel Danny Bopp, Ohio representative from the 88th District in the House of Representatives. He asked me to send Congress a message, stay the course. He also asked me to send Congressman Murtha a message that cowards cut and run, Marines never do. Danny and the rest of America and the world want the assurance from this body that we will see this through.
The House will be in order. 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 The gentlelady will suspend, and the clerk will report her words.
The gentlelady said cowards cut and run. Then the mics were cut for 10 minutes while the GOP leadership persuaded Congresswoman Schmidt, who is not only the newest member of Congress, but also beat out an Iraq War veteran to take the seat, to request her remarks be struck from the record.
My remarks earlier tonight were not directed at any specific member of the House, and certainly not at the honorable gentleman from Pennsylvania, Mr. Murtha. But like the saying goes, if you can't take the heat, stay out of the kitchen. I meant me. I meant that I'm the freshman representative here, not Congressman Murtha, who has been serving his country with distinction for a coon's age. An expression I always thought referred to the longevity of raccoons. Although it occurs to me now I may have been wrong about that. Donna Brazil, you have my apologies. Hopefully we can all move on from this issue and, like the Beatles said, let it be. Because I think we all can agree that the Beatles were not that great of a band.
It's not me. It's the public is thirsting for an answer to this thing. They want us to solve this problem. They don't want recriminations. They don't want a war of words. This is a real war where people are being hurt, and they want a solution to this this very difficult problem.
I think the political and social chaos we are seeing on every side reflects an underlying biologic crisis. End of the human line. All species are doomed from conception, like all individuals. Evolution did not come to a reverent halt with Homo sapiens. We have the technologies to recreate a flawed artifact and to produce improved and variegated models designed for space conditions. Perhaps there is still time. Is this being done or even considered? Back to the church, the home, and the family. Back to the simple American virtues that made this country great and can make this country great again. If I may be allowed a flight of whimsy involving articulate dinosaurs, fellow reptiles, I do not hesitate to tell you that we face grave. I do not hesitate to tell you that we have the answer. Size is the answer. Increase size. There are those who say size is not the answer. There are those who even propose that we pollute our pure reptilian strain with mammalian amalgamations and crossbreeding. And I say to you, if the only way I could survive was by mating with egg-eating rats, then I would choose not. But we will survive. We will increase both in size and in numbers. And we will continue to dominate this planet as we have done for 300 million years. Bigger is better, and biggest is best. Armored models thump their tails in earth-shaking applause. Herbivorous dens wallow and splash in swamp mud. Carnivores bear their huge fang, dripping streamers of saliva in approval. But a wise old dinosaur turns sadly from the TV and addresses his offspring. Son, it's the end of the line. We are ugly, idiot, bellowing beasts. Some of us are 60 feet long with a brain the size of a walnut. Where can this end? In a natural history museum, our bones talked out by pimply adolescents. Say, I wonder how big the creek was. Their turn. Back to the home and the family. Back to simple American virtues. Biologically speaking, the one direction you can't go is back. It's the law. Dolphins lived on land at one time. We know that because they have air-breathing lungs. Now that they have returned to the sea, it might be handy to reclaim their lost gills. No glut, clump, blighty. An evolutionary step that involves biologic alterations is irretrievable. We must now make such a step if we are to survive at all. And it had better be good. I have predicted the transition from time into space will involve biologic alterations. Such alterations are already manifest. Astronauts stand to lose their bones and teeth in the thermic. If you don't use it, you lose it. A skeleton has no function in a weightless state. So what does the end result look like? Well, rather like an octopus or a jellyfish. Bo Brummel, the restoration dandy, spent hours every morning putting exactly the right crease into his cravats. By lowering his chin, just so. Often his valet would carry out armfuls of crumpled linen. Obvious. So we can imagine the cosmic butler carrying out bundles of unworkable monstrosities. Obvious.
Writers imagine that they cull stories from the world. I'm beginning to believe that vanity makes them think so. That it's actually the other way around. Stories cull writers from the world. Stories reveal themselves to us, the public narrative, the private narrative. They colonize us, they commission us, they insist on being told. Fiction and non-fiction are only different techniques of storytelling. For reasons that I don't fully understand, fiction dances out of me, and non-fiction is wrenched out by the aching, broken world I wake up to every morning. The theme of much of what I write, fiction as well as non-fiction, is the relationship between power and powerlessness, and the endless circular conflict they're engaged in. John Berger, that most wonderful writer, once wrote, "Never again will a single story be told as though it's the only one. There can never be a single story. There are only ways of seeing. So when I tell a story, I tell it not as an ideologue who wants to pit one absolutist ideology against another, but as a storyteller who wants to share her way of seeing. Though it might appear otherwise, my writing is not really about nations and histories. It's about power, about the paranoia and ruthlessness of power, about the physics of power. I believe that the accumulation of vast, unfettered power by a state or a country, a corporation or an institution, or even an individual, a spouse, a friend, a sibling, regardless of ideology, results in excesses such as the ones I will recount here. living as I do, as millions of us do, in the shadow of the nuclear holocaust that the governments of India and Pakistan keep promising their brainwashed citizenry, and in the global neighborhood of the war against terror, what President Bush rather biblically calls the task that never ends. I find myself thinking a great deal about the relationship between citizens and the state. In India, those of us who have expressed views on nuclear bombs, big dams, corporate globalization, and the rising threat of communal Hindu fascism, views that are at variance with the Indian governments, are branded anti-national. While this accusation doesn't fill me with indignation, it's not an accurate description of what I do or how I think. Because an anti-national is a person who is against his or her own nation and by inference is pro some other one. But it isn't necessary to be anti-national to be deeply suspicious of all nationalism, to be anti-nationalism. Nationalism of one kind or another was the cause of most of the genocide of the 20th century. Flags are bits of colored cloth that governments use first to shrink wrap people's brains and then as ceremonial shrouds to bury the dead. When independent thinking people, and here I do not include the corporate media, begin to rally under flags, when writers, painters, musicians, filmmakers suspend their judgment and blindly yoke their art to the service of the nation, it's time for all of us to sit up and worry. In India, we saw it happen soon after the nuclear tests in 1998 and during the Kargil War against Pakistan in 1999. In the US, we saw it during the Gulf War, and we see it now during the war against terror, that blizzard of made-in-China American flags. Recently, those who have criticized the actions of the US government, myself included, have been called anti-American. Anti-Americanism is in the process of being consecrated into an ideology. The term anti-American is usually used by the American establishment to discredit, and not falsely, but shall we say inaccurately, define its critics. Once someone is branded anti-American, the chances are that he or she will be judged before they are heard, and the argument will be lost in the welter of bruised national pride. But what does the term anti-American mean? Does it mean you're anti-jazz, or that you're opposed to free speech, that you don't delight in Toni Morrison or John Updike, that you have a quarrel with giant sequoias? Does it mean that you don't admire the hundreds of thousands of American citizens who marched against nuclear weapons, or the thousands of war resistors who forced their government to withdraw from Vietnam? Does it mean that you hate all Americans? This sly conflation of America's culture, music, literature, the breathtaking physical beauty of the land, the ordinary pleasures of ordinary people, with criticism of the US government's foreign policy, about which, thanks to America's free press, sadly most Americans know very little, is a deliberate and extremely effective strategy. It's like a retreating army taking cover in a heavily populated city, hoping that the prospect of hitting civilian targets will deter enemy fire. But there are many Americans who would be mortified to be associated with their government's policies. The most scholarly, scathing, incisive, hilarious critiques of the hypocrisy and the contradictions in US government policy come from American citizens. When the rest of the world wants to know what the US government is up to, we turn to Noam Chomsky, Edward Said, Howard Zinn, Ed Herman, Amy Goodman, Michael Albert, Chalmers Johnson, William Bloom, and Anthony Arnov to tell us what's really going on.
This has been Mind Walk, an Upstart Radio production for nonprofit use.